down. Where are microphones for short people, I ask you? So good evening, and welcome to the World Affairs Council of Northern California, and to tonight's program, Inside the Obama White House. We are really quite honored to have with us this evening Jonathan Alter, who's senior editor of Newsweek magazine. My name is Ann Kenner. I'm a trustee of the World Affairs Council, and it's really a pleasure to be your moderator this evening. For those of you who may be new to our organization, the World Affairs Council was established in 1947 to engage the public in the exploration of issues and opportunities that transcend borders. And I invite you to find out more about the World Affairs Council by referencing our website at www.itsyourworld.org. If you are unable to attend a program, we offer two excellent ways for you to stay in touch. You may listen to our weekly radio broadcast, It's Your World, which airs every Monday evening on KQED. And on our website, you can find a full audio and visual archive of all of our past programs. This evening's program with Mr. Alter is actually being recorded for radio this evening, and I'd like to thank our radio engineer, Jane Heaven, in advance for her assistance. And actually, along those lines, if I could take you, or ask you to take the opportunity at this moment to just kindly silence your beepers and pagers and PDRs and watches and Pezzes and anything else you might have that could go off and interrupt the program, this would be a great time to turn them off. While you're doing that, I'd like to also call your attention to the blue question cards that you might have seen on your seats as you came in. Those cards present an opportunity for you to write down your questions for Mr. Alter. I encourage you to do so. Council staff will circulate around the auditorium during the first half of the program and collect those questions for me, and I will make every opportunity to get through them, or as many of them as possible, during the second half of the program. Finally, let me announce two upcoming programs at the World Affairs Council that you might find of particular interest. The first is this Friday, June 18th. The Council will welcome Stephen Kinzer, who is an award-winning foreign correspondent. He'll be discussing America's future strategy in the Middle East. Mr. Kinzer has interesting ideas for highlighting two new potential partners for us in the Middle East, in Iran and Turkey, and also ideas for moderating and adapting our relationships with our traditional partners in the Middle East, Israel and Saudi Arabia. That program will take place here at 12 o'clock in the Council Auditorium where we're sitting now. Then on Monday 21st, a very exciting program, the World Affairs Council will host the Honorable George P. Schultz as he discusses the recent film documentary, The Nuclear Tipping Point. And Mr. Schultz's comments will be followed by a screening of the film. Mr. Schultz will offer an insight into how America can take the lead in creating a world free of nuclear weapons. The event will take place here again Monday, the 21st, in the World Affairs Council Auditorium at 6 o'clock. And because it is going to be a high-demand opportunity, it will be open to members only. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished guest. Jonathan Alter is a senior editor at Newsweek magazine and a frequent correspondent to NBC News. He is the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, a remarkable book. I read that myself. Mr. Alter appears twice weekly on The Countdown with Keith Olbermann, a program on MSNBC, and he's a frequent commentator on NBC Nightly News, Meet the Press, CNBC, and The Stephen Colbert Show. Mr. Alter has also earned several awards for his political columns, including a first prize from the National Headliner Awards for a series of columns that he wrote about life after September 11th. Mr. Alter was also part of the team of Newsweek reporters and editors who were awarded the very prestigious National Magazine Award for General Excellence in 1993, 2002, and yet again in 2004. His newest book, The Promise, President Obama, Year One, involves an examination of the successes and failures of the Obama administration in its first year in office. Please join me in welcoming Jonathan Alter.
Thank you, Ann, and thank you all for coming tonight. I'm looking forward to a good, spirited, interactive discussion. And I thought I would just try to kind of tell you what I tried to do in this book, which I kind of view as history on the fly. It's very early to make definitive conclusions about Barack Obama, but I kind of go for the old proverb that we're cursed to live in interesting times, and that sometimes when history is happening around you, it's very hard to realize that at the time, and only later do you realize that very big things were going on. I would say, generally speaking, the bigger things were on the domestic side than internationally in his first year, but we may find that the seeds of really big things, like, say, Iranian nuclear development, took place in that first year, and maybe some of these things we should have paid closer attention to. So you have a kind of a lot of things going on at once, a president who has to multitask, who said to me at one point, you know when an H1N1 virus, a pandemic, is your sixth or seventh most important issue, you know you've got a full plate as president. So what I tried to do is essentially three things to explain what happened. Now, you might say, well, I know what happened. I read the papers. But the truth is that it's very hard for any reporter, even the very best reporters, to find out what's going on in real time behind the scenes. So on, say, what happened with the response to the BP oil spill, what happened in the Oval Office, it will be weeks or maybe months before the full story, certainly not before the leak is plugged. People just won't talk about it. No matter how much access you have, no matter who you know, there's a timing to this. And I found that often I would be beating my head against the wall, not getting anything from my sources until a little bit of time had passed, and then I could go back and find out what happened when the cameras were off, when that door to the Oval Office closes, when the Situation Room, where they deal with national security policy, what's going on in there. So that was really my first objective, to tell the backstory of the first year. My aim was to try to have something fresh on every page that simply hadn't been reported before. So I took off my pundit hat, put on the reporter hat, So the second objective, which is related, is what's he like? This is the most observed and least understood person on the planet, arguably. And I wanted to give a sense of his decision-making style, particularly on foreign policy. And I resolved to provide the most complete story of a decision to go to war, to escalate a war that has yet been done. And it was aided by the fact that, unlike the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, they actually debated the assumptions behind the intervention over a 20-hour period. It was the most extensive debate on a national security issue at the highest levels since the 13 days of deliberations over the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Now, you might think that's hard to believe. How could they not have, surfaced the issues for debate? But as Tom Donilon of the National Security Council told me, they made a study of it, and they found that we had gone inch by inch into Vietnam and into Iraq without actually having a full discussion of the issues. And I knew this to be true for two reasons. One is, I had studied the Vietnam War and written my thesis in college about how we went to war in Vietnam in 1963 and 64, and I knew they hadn't had these meetings. And the second reason was that in the 1990s, Newsweek bought Robert McNamara's book about Vietnam, which he wrote many years after he left government. He left in 67, and this was in, 97 maybe? It was like 30 years later. And I was assigned to go down and interview him. and I did the first print interview. Diane Sawyer did the first television interview with him about the Vietnam War. And then when I interviewed him in subsequent years, when we talked about Iraq, he said, well, the big mistake they're making is the same mistake we made. They never surfaced the key issues for debate, the assumptions behind the war. Hard to believe. Sending young men and women to die, they never had a full discussion about it. So Obama resolved to do that differently, and I resolved to get as much information as I could about the way that process worked. I have my doubts that they came to the right decision, but we don't know yet. The auguries are not favorable right now, but I thought it was important to provide a full sense of how he decides and the kinds of questions he asks and the way his mind works. I have a chapter called Zen Temperament that explains the way his temperament interacts with his decision making, and another one that I call the Un-Bubba that compares him to Bill Clinton. I thought the comparisons to George W. Bush were less interesting, a little more obvious. I dispense with those in a couple of sentences. But Obama and Clinton both have big brains. They're both left-handed, and they have a lot in common, but they also have a lot of differences. And I was interested in that Obama is essentially a vertical, deductive thinker, and Clinton is a horizontal, inductive thinker. I'm a little more inductive myself. You might be able to tell from this lecture. Inductive is sometimes another way of saying disorganized. But sometimes inductive thinking can yield more creativity. So I would maybe give Clinton the edge on a connective intelligence that makes interesting connections between seemingly disparate issues, and you can get some breakthroughs that way conceptually. The advantage of Obama's much more organized thinking is he's much more decisive than the man that those who work for both Clinton and Obama, and I spoke to a number of them, the man they call the second guesser in chief, Bill Clinton. He was always revisiting his decisions and ruminating, and Obama dislikes what he calls relitigating issues, a big insult if he says, don't relitigate this. So he's a deductive, vertical thinker who drills down into a problem in a way that Deepwater Horizon might have learned something from, because he does it in a very efficient and safe way, but also one that is impressive in its discipline and testing of assumptions. And in a crisis, and there were many, it's arguably preferable to the inductive reasoning, even though in any other given situation, sometimes the inductive will be preferable. But I think in the first year, the Obama style, at least for the people who worked for both, had its advantages. Temperamentally, they obviously differ. Bill Clinton was famous for his purple fits. He'd kind of, you know, rip people's face off. But then you'd get that warm embrace afterward. I love you, man. I love you. I still love you. And so people felt like they were back in his good graces. With Obama, it's 60 degrees all the time. It's not exactly chilly, but it's not exactly warm either. It's businesslike, and you don't get him ripping into people. And a lot of folks in government really appreciate that. They don't like the President of the United States ripping them a new one. But you also don't get that warm embrace afterwards, so you're not quite as sure where you stand with him. Although you know that if he trash talks you a little bit, which he likes to do, that he probably likes you. And he also has a Socratic method where he goes around the room and questions people out of order. Often in Washington, the meetings in the cabinet room or in the Roosevelt room have a hierarchy that is traditional, where the principals, as they call them, cabinet secretaries or members of Congress, heads of big agencies, they sit at the table, and then their deputies, assistant secretaries, staff people, the experts, sit around the wall. And normally, the principals do most of the talking, and maybe they'll refer a little bit to the experts. Obama likes to flip that and hear just a little bit from the principals and then start questioning the experts. You could argue, which I do, that he might have too much of a weakness for experts, what I call policy mandarins. These are used to be called the best and the brightest during the Vietnam War. And these are highly educated folks who have experience in government. Most of them have never met a payroll. As Lyndon Johnson complained, they haven't run for sheriff, so they don't maybe have as much horse sense as they might. Joe Biden's chief of staff told me, only half jokingly, he felt a little insecure because he went to Georgetown undergrad and Harvard Law School instead of Harvard undergrad and Harvard Law School. The flack, the publicist for the Office of Management and Budget, is an Oxford PhD. So they kind of have this belief, or Obama has this belief, that with enough expertise you can get to the right answer, or at least the least bad answer. And I think it's true that brains helps, especially in contrast to the way some previous administrations approached it, where the decisions on who to have around you were based on ideology. You increase your batting average if you have a rational decision-making process. Now, the first question I tried to answer is what happened. The second is what's he like in meetings and on the basketball court. And then the third question I tried to answer was how did he do, which is the one that most people want to know about, but I actually consider to be in some ways less important, because all of you can make your own judgments about how he did on various issues. And my objective was to give you more information on which to draw your own conclusions. So I do draw some tentative conclusions here and there on different issues. And at the end of the book, I go through, since it's called The Promise, I go through quite a number of his promises to see which ones he kept and which ones he didn't. But that's a secondary or even tertiary goal that I had, and it was more to give a sense of the hidden history of this period. So in the what happened department, I think I'll spare you some of the healthcare stories, since we're at the World Affairs Council, and give you some sense, not just of Afghanistan, which I'll get to in a minute, but of some of the other big foreign policy decisions. And one of my favorite stories involves the climate change conference in Copenhagen. You may remember that Obama went to Copenhagen earlier to try to get the Olympics for Chicago. And he really shouldn't have gone. They finished third. And when he got back, his staff asked him, why'd you go? And he said, Michelle would have killed me if I hadn't gone. She was involved in preparing the Olympics. And so then, several weeks later, suddenly this climate change conference is upon them. And Obama doesn't really want to go because it doesn't look like it's going to work. And they're really not, the prelude to the conference was disturbing, and the opening days of the conference even more so. He because the Congress hadn't passed climate change legislation, it was clear it was not going to be another Kyoto, and that we're not going to have binding emission standards or any of the other things that so many people had hoped for. But it was pointed out, rightly, by critics that if you're going to go to Copenhagen to get the Olympics for Chicago, the least you can do is go to Copenhagen to try to save the planet. So he decided that he would go at the end of the conference to try to salvage something. And when he arrived in the Bella Center in an abandoned shopping mall in Copenhagen, the conference was draped in failure. Hillary Clinton had been there for 11 days, and they were getting basically nothing accomplished. They did have some tentative agreement on a $100 billion fund for the developing world and those nations that are almost about to disappear, the low-lying islands that may disappear in not-too-distant future. And so there was some money they were talking about for some of the consequences of climate change, but nothing particularly significant. And so the Americans decided that they would try to salvage something, which turned out to be what they call a registry, so that at least there was some elemental transparency about which nations were emitting which levels of carbon. And the Chinese in particular had been very resistant because they really didn't have much of any tradition of this kind of international transparency. So when Obama arrived on the 11th day of the conference, he wanted to see Premier Wen, the number two in China, who he had just seen in Beijing a few weeks earlier, and they had had a good discussion on climate change. And he spent, part of the day. He met with Medvedev to try to make some advances on the START treaty, which turned out in 2010 to have been very useful in laying the groundwork for completing that treaty. But he was having trouble getting an appointment with Premier Wen. He got a little snappish. He said, "Look, I just want to see Premier Wen. I'm tired of this kind of everybody blackbearing everybody, trying to set these things up with to no effect." So they finally get an agreement. The thing is such a failure that the Americans hear that Prime Minister Singh has already gone to the airport. And the developing world, which is represented by China, Brazil, South Africa, and India, is angry at the Americans and not likely to come to any kind of agreement. So the advance team goes into the meeting room in this abandoned shopping mall where they're supposed to meet with the president's supposed to meet with Premier Wen, and they see that there's already a meeting going on in there, and they hear that it is the Chinese, Singh of India, who hasn't gone to the airport, Lula of Brazil, and Zuma of South Africa. And so Obama says, let's crash this thing. So they, so he walks in, and Minister Xi of China, who's the environment and energy minister and a hardliner, sees the President of the United States walking in and yells in mixture of Chinese and English, "Out, out!" And Obama ignores this, and he walks in and he says, "No chairs." And then, "Oh, there's one over there." And he pulls up a chair and says, "Hey, Lula, what's up? What's going on? My friend Lula." So he sits down next to Lula, and he's got Hillary Clinton with him and Todd Stern, who's the special envoy for climate change, and Mike Froman of the NSC, who's his friend from Harvard Law School, who has some responsibility for the issue. And they sit down, and they give Hillary some, she, with some of the foreign ministers, they start negotiating some of the details, and Froman and Stern negotiate some of the details. And they have about 90 minutes of negotiations on this idea of a registry. And they make a lot of progress, and they're down to the short strokes. And, you know, it's not what people had hoped for, but it's going to salvage something out of this conference. And suddenly, Minister Xi starts yelling, like really screaming, at Premier Wen in Chinese. And the heads of state, you know, everybody looks at the interpreter. And Premier Wen says something in Chinese to the interpreter. And the interpreter says, "For internal discussion only, internal use only." And at that point, Obama goes like this. He says, "I'll take that to mean we have an agreement." And he stands up and hikes out of the room. And the Chinese had to live with the agreement that they had hammered out. So I wasn't in Copenhagen. I wasn't, you know, there were 1,000 reporters credentialed. I wasn't one of them. I was at home working on my book. But by circling back a few months later, you know, I was able to get the only story of what happened inside that room. And that's what I tried to do on a variety of other issues. I got very interested in the way Obama responded to terrorism. It turns out it's been a much bigger part of his day than people realize. They scrapped the old Presidential Daily Brief, the PDB, as it was called, in several administrations, and they replaced it with something called a National Security Session, which is quite a bit longer than the old daily briefing, and at least once a week they go over what they call the threat charts. And the president considers us to be at war with Al-Qaeda. He does not believe that it's a war on terror. He thinks terror is a tactic. And he certainly doesn't believe in using words like Islamofascism, because so much of the initiative of his first year was reaching out to the Muslim world, starting with his decision to use his full name when he was sworn in as president, which Jimmy Carter and other previous presidents did not do. And he did that consciously. And then his first interview was given to an Arab a television station based in London. And he gave holiday greetings repeatedly to the Arab world as a way of reaching out to the Muslim world. Then you know about the Cairo speech, which was arguably one of the most important speeches he's ever given. But behind the scenes, he's very busy signing presidential findings, as they're called, to use predator drones to kill as many high-value Al-Qaeda targets as possible. And so I was struck by, these are all what they call black ops. They're all run by the CIA as joint operations with the Pentagon. It's very hard to get information about them, but I was struck by how much of the president's time is spent on these high-value targets. And Joe Biden, who's can always be counted on to be a little bit indiscreet, so that's why we love him, gave the scorecard. You might say it's kind of like the body count in Vietnam, but in this case, it's not Viet Cong peasants that aren't really a national security threat to the United States, but the leaders of a terrorist organization who want to kill us. So the body count makes a little bit more sense. And I think at the end of 2009, I might be getting these numbers wrong, I've got them in the book, they'd killed 15 high-value targets. These are leaders of Al-Qaeda, and about 100 Al-Qaeda associates. And we don't know how many innocent civilians, but fewer than in the past. Early on, after the Air Force dropped a 2,000-pound bomb with a B-2 bomber on in the border region, the AFPAC border, and killed a whole bunch of civilians, the president and the Pentagon canceled bombing, which did not get very much attention, but we do not bomb anymore in that region because it was counterproductive. We were killing a lot of innocent civilians, and it wasn't helping the American cause. So instead, they used these Predator drones, pilotless aircraft, which lock onto, you know, an individual target, maybe a Al-Qaeda, you know, big shot sunbathing on the roof of a building in Yemen, and they nail him. And the president makes no apologies for it, because he sees his first job as protecting the national security of the United States. And as he said in his West Point speech, which is the day after I interviewed him, that's his first responsibility. And he went to some pains in that speech to draw a contrast between Afghanistan and Vietnam. First time any president had actually refuted an historical analogy. Usually they embrace an historical analogy to make their point. And in this case, he was saying there are a lot of differences. He doesn't believe that the Taliban have the support of the population, that they rule by terror and fear, and that Al-Qaeda does pose a direct national security threat to the United States in the way the Viet Cong did not, and a series of other distinctions. And I got very interested in the Pentagon's view of the lessons of history and the Vietnam books they read versus the books that the White House read about Vietnam, and they're quite different books with different interpretations, all of which played into these deliberations. What happened in the Situation Room in September and October of 2009 was, I think, a great case study in presidential decision making. Obama and Biden essentially played good cop, bad cop, and they went back over and over and over again in questioning the Pentagon, questioning their assumptions, when they found the budget assumptions to be out of whack. Obama did something, I think, unprecedented. He brought Peter Orszag, his OMB director, into the Situation Room. Nobody could remember a domestic budget director being brought in that way, but that's how much distrust there was over the Pentagon's numbers. And when he heard things that were disturbing, some of which were already in the public domain that many of you might have known about, he often did things immediately. So, for instance, he asked the Pentagon brass, is it really true that the Afghan National Army pays less than the Taliban, so that an Afghan trying to feed his family has a couple of offers of a job, and you know he goes with the Taliban because they pay more money? Turns out it was true. So he said, we will direct money so that the Afghan National Army pays more than the Taliban. We will do so effective immediately, and that is an order. He actually has to. I was really kind of surprised to learn that the president, as commander-in-chief, has to actually say, so there's no ambiguity, that is an order. In December, they had their highest recruitment success in many years in the Afghan army. Now, 6 months later, it was just in the papers that the United States is not effectively training all those recruits, that there's plenty of recruits, but we haven't gotten the trainers in place, which is an example of the many, you know, complexities of this operation. Obama at first did not tip his hand about what he was going to do. There had been an earlier escalation in March, and he, I think, felt that in some ways he had been pushed into that. So what he said to me was these fall deliberations, he said, I wanted to slow everything down. He knew that at the earliest, the new troop deployments wouldn't begin till the beginning of this year. So he had something really rare in foreign policy, time to make a measured, considered decision. And in the midst of this process, you may recall that something called the McChrystal Report was leaked. And it wasn't just that McChrystal's analysis was made public. Bob Woodward published it in the Washington Post. It was that McChrystal himself went public. You may remember seeing him on 60 Minutes, in magazines. He's talking about we need a open-ended counterinsurgency commitment. It's going to take a decade, maybe. Hillary Clinton very much sided with the Pentagon. It's going to take a long time. Joe Biden took a very different view. He had what was called, instead of a counterinsurgency plan, a counterterrorism plan, which would have required very few troops with more use of Predator drones and a focus on Al-Qaeda, not on the Taliban. And neither Biden nor Obama appreciated that the Pentagon was out there saying what they thought should happen before they'd made a decision. Remember, they're in the middle of these deliberations. So they send the word that that's not what they expect. And somehow General McChrystal didn't seem to get the memo, because he goes to London and gives a speech. And in the question and answer period afterward, he's asked, could you support a counterterror plan, the Biden plan, where you use very few troops and Predator drones? No big escalation, no big counterinsurgency nation building. And he says, not to be glib about it, but no. So in Washington, in the White House, they're thinking, wait a minute, let's get this straight. The commanding general is saying that if the president sides with the vice president, he can't support the policy? That's insubordination. What is that? You know? So Obama is in Copenhagen trying to get the Olympics for Chicago, and he summons McChrystal from London, and you might remember a picture of them on the tarmac in Copenhagen on Air Force One. And it turns out that he thinks that McChrystal is kind of in over his head in terms of publicity. He had worked in black ops in Iraq. And he's a good man, a good soldier, really gung-ho, living in forward base camps with the troops, the guy you want on the ground, not to mention the fact that they just fired General McKiernan, his predecessor, a couple of months ago. So even though Joe Biden wants some heads to roll, Obama thinks McChrystal's fine, but he's furious at his superiors. And when he gets back to Washington, he summons Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the Oval Office for a dressing down that was compared to when Truman fired MacArthur in 1951. They said there's never been a direct confrontation like this in the years since. When I heard that from the National Security Council, I said that can't be right, and I researched it, and I looked at the relationship between the Commander-in-Chief and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs going back 50 years, and I couldn't find case. It wasn't like there was, you know, George H.W. Bush dressing down Norman Schwarzkopf or what. These things just hadn't happened. And what Obama, he was described as being in a cold fury, and he said, I want to know here and now that this behavior will stop. This conduct is doing a disservice, quote, to the men and women in uniform and to our country, and I'm exceedingly unhappy about it. When I asked him in the interview, before I knew the full details, none of which had come out at the time, I said, were you jammed by the Pentagon? And the president said, quote, I neither confirm nor deny that I was jammed by the Pentagon. You know what that means. Mullen left the meeting, described himself as chagrined. Petraeus, who some in the White House thought had been running for president, Petraeus's response to that was, what part of no don't they understand, was not in that meeting because he was Mullen was his superior, but he was told to change his conduct in this matter too. And Gates, who was in the meeting, Mullen and Petraeus all issued public statements saying that a general's advice to the president should be confidential and they should not try to advance their policy objectives in the press. So the president pushed back hard on that, but when it came time to decide on a policy, it ended up being sort of a combination of McChrystal and Biden. Certainly sided with McChrystal on troop strength. We're close to 100,000 now. But he did not side with the Pentagon and with Hillary Clinton on the duration of the commitment or on the pace of the escalation. Petraeus told him in the Situation Room that it would be a 21-month escalation. And the president said, well, it took us 6 months to surge in Iraq. And Petraeus said, well, that was a different situation. And Obama said, wait, you just got done in your prior presentation in an earlier meeting saying it was like Iraq. That's the basis of Petraeus's great prestige, is the success of the surge, which Obama had been against, incidentally, and wrong about. And so Petraeus said, okay, well, we can do it in 6 months. And the Pentagon came back with a plan for a quick-in, quick-out approach with a loophole, conditions on the ground permitting a withdrawal beginning in July of 2011. In the month since, this obviously hasn't gone well, just yesterday, John McCain, who takes it on the chin for me in the early part of the book, read a page from my book to General Petraeus in the Senate Armed Services Committee, the page where I describe the meeting in the Oval Office where Obama is extremely clear with Petraeus and Mullen and Gates that they agree that they can complete the mission so that we can begin a withdrawal in 2011. And they all say they agree with that. And McChrystal wanted to know, is this really true? Did this really happen? And Petraeus yesterday said, I can't comment on my private conversations with the president. But the Republicans smell an issue here that somehow the president, you know, forced the Pentagon to do something over their objections when it came to getting out of Afghanistan sooner. So all of this is still at issue. We don't know how it's going to play out. But the process I found fascinating, and I was more interested in explaining that than trying to do what we're always asked to do on TV, which is, how will it work? Will it succeed? We're going to, you know, it's like asking, is the stock market going to go up or down? You know, I don't necessarily have any better understanding or more knowledge about whether it will work or won't work than anybody else in this room. But I think what we can do and what historians and journalists should try to do is tell us more of what happened, which is what I endeavored to do on this issue. There are a whole other set of foreign policy issues that we can maybe get into in the Q&A. The one that Barack Obama cared the most about in the Senate when he went on a trip to the former Soviet Union with Richard Lugar is nuclear nonproliferation. He chaired the first ever Security Council meeting at the UN devoted to this issue, and then a big conference this year on this. And he considers loose nukes to be the number one national security threat to the United States, and he's determined to try to do something about it. Gave an important speech in Prague. There are a whole series of other foreign policy issues where he didn't do as well. He acknowledged to me that he had, quote, failed in the Middle East. In making progress on the Arab-Israeli dispute. He's got George Mitchell working hard on that. But he's quite proud of his success on driving a stake between Iran and Russia and getting Russia and China to join in IAEA, supporting IAEA inspections and some sanctions against Iran and bringing pressure to bear in the international community. And he did make some advances on that. But the deliverables, as they call them, are still mostly to be completed. And so it's early to make firm judgments about the success or failure of his foreign policy. A lot of it is in process, and I actually don't have a lot of patience with people who either you know, cheerlead for him on this or decide they want to lambaste him for having failed, because he and Hillary Clinton planted a lot of seeds with their policy of engagement, and we don't really know yet which ones have borne fruit. In general terms, I think the way to describe him is the way John F. Kennedy described himself to Jackie when they were dating, which is an idealist without illusions. In his speech accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, which he thought was undeserved, and which anybody on the day he received it who chose to thought about toasting him thought better of it, because they know that he so dislikes kiss-ups that he would have held it against him if they did so. But upon accepting the award in Oslo, he said that he thought that the classic division between realists and idealists in American foreign policy was a, quote, false choice, which he rejected as a distinction. And he obviously sees himself as some combination of the two. I think with that, it might make sense for me to stand down, and I welcome all of your questions and thoughts. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Alter. You referred in your early comments this evening to the fact that the president has a lot of faith in the policy mandarin that's drawn into his purview. And in your book, you also refer to his general overconfidence in the American public, which is a little insulting, but that he trusts perhaps all of us more than he should. You've repeated that sentiment in an interview on Charlie Rose, saying that you believe the president is more credulous than he should be, and that he trusts experts more than he should. Given that his foreign policy is basically bookended by a desire to engage and to work with international actors who aren't traditionally well-disposed towards the United States, do you think his credulousness might have some ominous implications for our national security?
No. And actually, I don't think I used that word credulous on Charlie Rose. I do think that he has a bit of a weakness for experts, but I don't think he's a sap or naive. And I think those who level that charge or level the charge that he's been somehow, you know, on an apology tour for the United States have not been listening to his speeches, and they're just trying to axe grind for their own political agendas. So I don't think that he goes into these negotiations naively. You know, it's interesting, during the campaign in the YouTube debate, he supposedly made this gaffe by saying that he was ready to negotiate with basically anybody, and afterwards they wanted him to kind of retreat from that, and he said no. And this was so consistent with who he has always been, going back to his time in Chicago, where he would meet with, you know, William Ayers, you know, a former bomber terrorist, and the mayor, you know, and basically meet with anybody on the Israeli side, on the Palestinian side, and he believes in talking. I think that's the right approach. And so does Jim Baker, interestingly. You know, he was very critical of the Bush folks. I think we should have diplomatic relations with Iran. You know, the point, it's easy to talk to your friends. Diplomacy is about talking to your adversaries. And to put it in the crudest terms, you know, the problem with Chamberlain was not that he went to Munich to take Hitler's measure. It was that he gave him Czechoslovakia when he got there, you know. So there's nothing wrong with meeting with bad guys. Or in the case of, you know, he shook Hugo Chavez's hand. Ooh, you know, the right wing. Ooh, he shook Hugo Chavez's hand. Or the right wing went crazy, you know. So I don't worry about his credulousness internationally. I worry that he might not have the contrast to Clinton is so interesting on this. Clinton was not very interested in the chessboard, in the various strategic judgments. And Obama is always trying to play what his friends call 3D chess, and saying, how can we say, and the most important of these was drive a stake between Iran and Russia, which they pretty much succeeded in doing. They're squabbling now. It's wonderful for American interests. But Clinton has the edge when it comes to a kind of subtle assessment of the motives of foreign leaders and the interplay of personality and politics. Partly because Obama's just meeting these folks, I think he's not quite where he needs to be in understanding what's going on in the heads of his adversaries. But I don't think he's done anything that could be described as dangerous so far.
Thank you. A number of our audience members are very curious to delve more deeply into the president's relationship with his advisors and with his cabinet members. They'd like to know specifically with whom he has the best rapport, who he consults before his most important decisions, and a number of people also ask you to address the president's choice of Hillary Clinton as a Secretary of State, something that you in your book call a powerful example of democracy and a model for peaceful power sharing. So if you would address that omnibus question, that would be great.
Yeah, I have a chapter called Picking Hillary, obviously a lot of Obama's people didn't want him to do it, and at one point he just says, and look guys, she's the most qualified, end of discussion, you know, I want the best person and she's it. Then he had to really twist her arm to do it. She didn't want to, and she finally agreed, and he appealed to her patriotism. And I think it is a sign, a powerful sign abroad, where when people are adversaries in politics, they often want to shoot each other to have them join, you know, in common cause. And Hillary Clinton has used it as a powerful example in her travels. They get along well. They have a surprisingly unfraught relationship. It started out a little shaky. It was described to me by one Assistant Secretary of State as kind of like a nervous teenager, you know, on her first date, and she was maybe a little too solicitous, and he was maybe a little too aloof with her, but apparently they got along better in private. Their staffs are at each other's throats all the time, and if people are interested in that, I kind of detail various squabbles over appointment of ambassadors and that kind of thing. They're not personally close in the same way that Obama and Biden, they played golf once, and when Biden won, Obama never invited him to play again. And he doesn't have him to Camp David. But in both cases, they have, you know, good professional relationships and see each other for lunch at least once a week. In some ways, the Biden relationship has been on a more interesting trajectory, because at the beginning, they really had some problems. Biden secretly advised Hillary when he was ostensibly neutral in the middle of 2008. Obama didn't care about that, but he really cared when Biden said during the fall campaign that Obama would be tested because he was so young and new. But Obama was really ticked about that. He thought he had such a big mouth that during the early transition, he excluded him from personnel meetings because they just weren't sure that it wouldn't leak. But then over time, he came to recognize that Biden was extraordinarily well informed on foreign policy and gave him solid advice, even though he didn't follow it on Afghanistan. He so trusted Joe Biden that he gave him the entire Iraq portfolio. This is not well known. And Biden travels there about once a month. And I was in Biden's office at one point when he was talking to Talabani on the phone. And he's very deft with foreign leaders. And Obama has come to really respect his judgment. So both of them have influence, but the most influential member of the cabinet is Bob Gates. and he gives Obama cover for all kinds of things. And also, they call him Yoda in the White House. He's just a guy who, even though on Afghanistan he was all over the lot, and I kind of chronicle where everybody was various points in that debate in the book, but he was all over the place, but his judgment is conditioned by real experience across several administrations. And even though Obama had no experience, he respected those who did. And most of the people he chose were chosen in part because they had some experience. Jim Jones, the National Security Advisor, was much maligned in the press early on. He's smart and briefs well, but he's kind of he's a former general who got used to having the colonels do a lot of the real work, and so in his case, he's delegated a huge amount of his responsibility to Tom Donilon, who's the Deputy National Security Advisor. And you know, obviously, there was a problem with Dennis Blair; they replaced him. Leon Panetta has a good relationship with the president, but he was on the defensive for much of the discussion over AFPAC because the intelligence record had been so pathetic, really, that he was, you know, constantly answering questions about why they didn't have better intelligence. Let's see, who have I not mentioned? You know, the thing about Obama's advisors is they're not as important as in other administrations because he is so in command. This is what people said over and over again. People liked him, people didn't like him. He has what in the military they call the habit of command. You know, when he walks in to the Situation Room, he's totally in charge. And for a guy who never really ran anything, never really had management experience, this was a revelation to a lot of people in the room. And Joe Biden said to me and others, they got the ticket in the right order. You know, he said that over and over again to me. And then, you know, he had wanted to fire people. Obama said no, and Biden concluded Obama's cooler head was right, that they shouldn't fire anybody. And they joked on the way to the Oval Office for the final meeting with the brass, you know, what would happen if Biden was president and was going to walk in. They would be scared that, you know, heads would roll. And Biden said he was glad that Obama was. So he does a certain amount of his just vice presidential apple polishing, but I think he's right. He said it would have taken me 2 years and Hillary 4 years to restore American prestige that Obama did overnight on the day he was elected. And even though there has been, particularly in Israel, there's been, you know, considerable erosion in the polls, still, if you go country by country to this day, you know, way over 60% approval ratings, in some cases 70, 80% approval ratings around the world. This is a good thing for the United States, even if one doesn't think he's a good president. It's kind of hard to say that, you know, restoring some of America's prestige is a bad thing. In terms of some of the assistant secretaries of state, there was some concern that there wasn't enough emphasis on human rights. Their assistant secretary for human rights is a guy named Mike Posner, who was head of the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, which became Human Rights First. As an example of the silliness of the vetting process, which I deal with in the book, Tom Malinowski, who works for Human Rights Watch, couldn't get that job because he had been a lobbyist, even though he'd been a lobbyist for human rights. A guy named Paul Farmer, some of you may have read Mountains Beyond Mountains by Tracy Kidder, a world-renowned humanitarian. He finally withdrew from a big job because the vetting process required him to name all of the foreign contacts he had, everybody who knew he knew who was lived abroad, and there were thousands, and he couldn't possibly do that, and you know, so there was a lot of silliness in that process, and Hillary rightly called it ridiculous how that went. So I think they didn't have as much trouble as the Treasury Department, but they had a lot of trouble in filling key posts in the State Department.
Just a quick follow-up on your comments about the president's response to being or not being boxed in by the Pentagon in Afghanistan. Why didn't heads roll? Should they have rolled? And one questioner asks, why did Obama not ask for Mullen's resignation?
I think the short answer is that they had just fired General McKiernan, who had been the commanding general in the region, a few months earlier, and it would have been really disruptive to the armed forces to have a big bloodletting at that point. And I'm not sure whether Obama would have fired him anyway, but that was clearly a factor. Biden was really interesting on the question of commissioning the McChrystal Report, which in some ways was the root of some of these problems. When they did so, he told a story from the early days in the Senate when Senator McClellan of Arkansas was the chairman of an important committee, and Biden wanted a subcommittee assignment. He was a 30-year-old freshman senator, and he goes and meets with them, and he said, well, let me send you a letter, you know, telling you what I'm after. And McClellan, and this is Biden imitating McClellan, says, son, I got a piece of advice for you. Never send a man a letter he doesn't want to receive. And so Biden concluded that the McChrystal Report was a letter that they didn't want to receive. They were not ready for him to make a series of recommendations based on, you know, he'd just gotten there. They wanted him to get a status report from him, maybe, but the mandate was much too broad, and as Obama later said, he should have known it was going to leak. These things always do if you put them on paper, and that caused them a lot of trouble.
We have just time for one more question.
I'm sorry I've been so long-winded on these answers.
But you've made us laugh. One more question. You spend a lot of your book talking about the president's frustration with having to be on shovel brigade, which you define as cleaning up after mistakes from the prior administration. One of our questioners notes that you commented that you have felt in your book that Bush administration work was really only worth a few sentences in comparison, and that you focused more on the Clinton administration. And this questioner asks you to elaborate a little bit more on the differences, both positive and negative, between the Bush administration experience in office and Obama's first year in office.
Well, that's a maybe a fit subject for another book. The contrast is really stark, and often new administrations overcompensate, and perhaps Obama has to some extent by rejecting instinct, you know, instinctive decision-making, which is what Bush did from his gut. And maybe Obama should rely a little more on his gut and a little less on his head. Maybe he's overreacting to Bush on that. Look, you know, the shovel brigade, which was Don Regan's line, he was Reagan's chief of staff, you know, that the shovel brigade cleans up after the elephants and the crap they leave when they leave the circus, you know. And that has been a lot of the story of the Obama administration. If you look at, you know, the bank bailouts, the auto bailouts, Afghanistan, which turned out to be much worse than they expected, pretty much everything except Iraq was a mess. And I think, and maybe this is a good note to end on, I think the BP spill is just another shovel brigade kind of thing. It's a mess that was left by Bush for Obama to clean up. Now you say, why was it left by Bush? Was it Bush's fault? Indirectly, yes, because the oil companies have no business drilling a mile down without proper regulation. And the regulators in the Minerals Management Service, in the Denver office, they were literally, not figuratively, literally sleeping with the people they were supposed to be regulating. And you know, it came out in congressional testimony yesterday, something that people have known for weeks, that their oil spill cleanup plans had dead people to contact. The oil companies all had the same plan, and it included animals that are only walruses that are found in Alaska, not in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, it was pathetic. And government must regulate dangerous activity. And, you know, this goes back to Theodore Roosevelt. And they deregulated Wall Street. The Clinton people contributed to that. And when it came to the extraction industry, you know, they came up with an energy policy in private that Dick Cheney ran, and that was a complete sellout to that industry, into the energy industry. I had a story a few years ago after the Enron story broke where I got a call and called up a guy named Ebert, who had been the chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and he had become embittered with the Bush administration, and he told me that the selection process in the Bush transition that led to his selection as chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission was run by Ken Lay. That Bush literally had Ken Lay choosing who the energy regulators would be. Not any intermediaries, not a friend of Ken Lay. Ken Lay himself choosing. Okay, so this is what they were left with. Now, if it hadn't been this disaster, it would have been something else. Or we did. We had a mine disaster. Now you're going to have those things are going to happen, even if there's a lot of regulation. Maybe this would have happened with proper regulation, but I don't think so, because they did not have proper redundancies and proper contingency plans and proper supervision of the interaction between the prime and subcontractors and all the rest. So it's of a piece. And I think Obama is frustrated by it, but he knows that this is the hand that history has dealt him to clean up Bush's messes. And one of the reasons that he pushed so hard on health care, and we haven't talked about that, was he wanted to do something that he thought was important for the American people and for the fiscal future of the country. As he said to me, if we didn't act on this, 70%, 7-0, he says, of non-defense spending would be consumed by entitlements, so we must bend the cost curve. But I think part of it, and he moved ahead alone, Rahm Emanuel told me, I begged the president not to do this, and part of it was that he didn't want his whole administration to be consumed by the shovel brigade. And as he said to a friend at the end of the year, he goes, I don't know why anybody would want this job for more than one term, but I guess I have to run, because otherwise Mitt Romney will get credit for all the good things we started after we've been through all this crap. So with that, I'll bring it to a close. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So I trust, Mr. Alter, that our audience is going to get some credit in your next book as having inspired you to write a book about the differences between the two administrations.
Know. Makes me tired thinking about
there
it.
There we go. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, please join me in thanking Jonathan Alter for sharing his insights with us. And I'd like to remind you that Mr. Alter's book is available for sale this evening, courtesy of Books, Inc. And Mr. Alter will agree to stay on stage and greet you and sign your books for you. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Anne.